So now what I like to talk about this afternoon is about what is, a little its context, the context of the question, and also its connection to awakening. Because in a way the path of the Buddha is very much about awakening. So I like to look at that, the question and the awakening. So first, I like to say a little of how I encountered this question. Like, I arrived in Korea, I became a nun. I arrived in Korea, I became a nun later. And so I arrived in this temple where there was this master, Master Kuzan. And we were taken, me and Larry, we were taken to see the master for the first time. And so he was sitting there, and I had never met a Zen master before. This was my first time when I was 22. This was in the 70s. And so I bowed to him as I was told to. And then he turned to me, and he asked me where I come from, and Larry also, where we come from, and things like this. And then he says, "What is the most precious thing in the world?" So I sit here and I think, oh, I must say something, you know, intelligent or clever or spiritual. What am I supposed to say? And I think, I think, I think. And finally I say, two people smiling at each other. And he says, "Not bad, but there is something more important and more precious than that, and it's to know your own mind, your own true mind. And in order to do that, you need to ask, what is this? What is this?" So that in a way, that was my first encounter with this question. And when our teacher, Master Kuzan, presented the question, the way he helped us to kind of, in a way, get a little feel for it, is that he would say, it is not a material object, because you cannot kind of designate the mind, the true mind, the awakened mind, as a material object. You can't say it's big, it's red, it's round. So it's not a material object. Then he said it's not a designation, not a name. I mean, you can call it the master of the body or whatever you want to call it, but it's just a name. It does not represent the experience of it itself. It is not empty space, because empty space does not speak, etc. And it is not the Buddha, because you are not awakened yet. So he would say, it's neither of these four things, then what is this? And then that's the way we would question. And then when we became, first before we become monks and nuns, we have to be postulant in the kitchen. So we have to wash the dishes and do various things of that nature. And so we would ask him, you know, how do we practice, you know, when we wash the dishes? Should we just be aware of washing the dishes? And he used to say, yes, yes, you're aware of washing the dishes, but at the same time you ask, what is it that is washing the dishes? So in a way you're always asking this question at the same time as you're aware of what you are doing. And personally I found over time, as I became more influent, more kind of familiar with this question, that actually it would give me energy. Like once I was working in the kitchen and it was cooking for hundreds of monks. And so you had to kind of have this huge cauldron and with the rice, and you have this huge fire, and you used to put big bundle in there. And I'm kind of small. And so in a way to have the energy, I would say, what is this? What is this? So there was kind of a rhythm with the question, which actually gave me energy, which I find often in the walking, that's what happened. You walk and you ask, what is this? What is it? And then you come back and sit and you feel kind of generally very bright, because the question is very much bringing energy and the brightness. Another thing that we used to do was, we used to sit during the meditation season 10 hours a day, and then every 2 weeks we would have a kind of a semi day off, because we had to clean ourselves and also listen to talks and do various washing. And there used to be also a talk once every 2 weeks. And at the end of the talk, we would go to Master Skuzan's room, just a Westerner, so I could translate, or somebody else could translate for the Westerner. And so we used to kind of go through the talk. And then at the end of it, Master Kuzan used to give us, you know, tea and cakes and be very nice to us, because he thought, you know, we're far from home, so he had to take care of us. And then we would be eating the cakes and drinking the tea, and he would say, "What is it that tastes of tea?" And then we could never answer. He would often kind of try to kind of make us kind of question what we were doing. Or if we were eating the cake, he would say, "Oh, is it good?" And we say, "Yes, it's good. What is it that tastes of cake?" So always like this. And then my husband, I mean, the one who became my husband later, but who was a monk then, Stephen Batchelor, you might know him. And he's very kind of philosophic. And he came before from the Tibetan tradition. So we had really practiced a lot of kind of intellectual inquiry. So he would try to engage Master Kuzan in this long kind of, you know, intellectual exchange. You know, what about this and what about that? And in that text, they said, in the Madhyamika. And so Master Kuzan would kind of go along, and I had to translate. And Master Kuzan would, you know, go along for two or three kind of these things. And then he would turn to him and say, "Pop John, do you know what it is?" And Stephen would say, "No, then go and ask, what is it?" So he would always try to make us question in this way. So I think also what we have to see is that the question is very much within a very, I would say, wide spiritual environment. That's why it's not an existential inquiry about the meaning of life. It's very much within a Buddhist environment. What is it? They hear the ring. And so this was very much within the environment of the three training. I think this is very important to see that the question is not asked just by itself. It's not an end in itself, but it's very much within this environment of the three training of ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And our teacher was very emphatic on that, that we needed to cultivate the three trainings equally: ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And each of them was helping each other to develop even more. So cultivating the three actually would enable us to develop them even more. And within that training, ethics was very much based on compassion, based on the fact that it's not about rule and regulation, but it's about how do we live in the world? How do we live with ourselves? How do we live with others? And at that level in the monastery, we would follow the 58 Bodhisattva precepts, which I recently translated, because why I translated them was because I could see that they influence the behavior in the monastery. And this Bodhisattva precept is very much based on the idea of compassion for self and others. That actually we're not trying to practice just for ourselves, but we practice also for the sake of others. And that was very evident in the way people would do things in the monastery. And in the monastery, there was this very interesting thing that would happen that the Westerner had a little trouble with. And this is what I would call the forgiveness method. That in Korea, in the monastery, if you made a mistake, the only thing you had to do was to go to the master or to somebody superior in rank and bow 3 times and say, "I made a mistake." And this was it. However bad it was what you did, this was it forever after. They would never mention it ever again. Because I find that in the West, we forgive, but we don't forget. And that, you know, later on we kind of say, oh yes, I forgive you, but later on you will bring it up again. But with them, not at all. And what was strange was, well, us Westerner, when the master cousin, for example, caught somebody doing something, and he would later say, hey, you did this, that was not good. And instead of bowing three times and saying, I made a mistake, we would say, oh, but yes, we know we had, you know, this reason and that reason, and we kind of, you know, try to justify ourselves. And Master Kuzan would be like, you know, what's the matter with them? It could be so simple. You just acknowledge it, you confess it in a way, and this is it. And we don't talk about it ever again. And actually, this comes from a precept in the Bodhisattva precept, which says that you must forgive those who ask for forgiveness. That if you somebody comes and asks you for forgiveness and you do not accept it and you remain angry, then actually this is a fault. This is kind of like seen as a misdemeanor. So in a way, our whole life in the monastery, in the nunnery, were based on this Bodhisattva precept, which also say about do not kind of take revenge, do not strike people, kind of care for the sick, be careful of nature. I mean, there is many, many precepts which are very much about a compassionate attitude toward the world. The fact that you're aware of the existence of others and you share the world together. Then, of course, there was a meditation. The meditation which was very much to ask the question, but also to kind of bring a certain awareness, a certain presentness of mind in everyday life, and to kind of, in a way, take care of the way we would behave and we would be. And of course, then there was wisdom. There was a wisdom of listening, the wisdom of reflecting, and of course, the experiential wisdom. Master Kuzan always pointed out, yes, it's good to listen, it's good to reflect, but the most important wisdom is wisdom of experience, that through the practice, through the ethics, we ourselves know something about the world that we had not perceived before. So very much the wisdom of, in a way, knowing the impermanence, the wisdom of knowing the unreliability, the wisdom of knowing the conditionality, that this actually would make a difference in the way we would live. So this was very much, in a way, the environment, kind of the ground of the practice, of the question. Also in our monastery, in our family, in a way, what I would call nearly, you could call our lineage, there was this founder of our monastery in the 12th century, Master Bojo. And Master Bojo, following another great master of China, Tsungmi, kind of followed this idea about awakening and practice. Because in the Zen tradition, you have two main strands. You have a strand which see the practice as sudden and the awakening as sudden. And it's called sudden-sudden. But personally, I think this is kind of a little difficult and a little too kind of... I'm not sure that it's workable, actually. And Master Chinul, our founder, advocated what is called a sudden awakening followed by gradual practice. So that he would see the life of practice, that we have a sudden insight, and then that insight gradually we have to incorporate it in our life, in our being. Then we have another insight, and then again, gradually it has to become kind of lived in our life. And that I could see very much in the example of my teacher, Master Kuzan, because he was reputed to have had three awakenings. And you might think, well, one should be enough, but he had had three. And what was beautiful, in Korea, when you have an insight, you go to your teacher to kind of check it out. And the third time, he had his insight, he went to his teacher, and then his teacher said, until now, you were my disciple. Now, you will become my teacher. Because his teacher realized that insight was greater than his own. And in a way, we have to see that a teacher is there to empower the disciple so that actually they can even become greater than themselves. But what was remarkable with my teacher, Master Kuzan, was that to the last day of his life. He might have had 3 awakenings and he was greatly respected, but to the last moment of his life, he practiced meditation. He would sit cross-legged. I mean, I traveled with him as his translator in Europe, in America. We would be in a train, in a plane, in a boat. He would cross his leg and he would ask, "What is this?" And I would sit next to him reading the paper. And he would say, "Hey, meditation?" And I would go, kind of, "Oh, I'm tired." But he really, anywhere, he would just sit and meditate. And before he died in Korea, we were walking together. And at one point he was a little tired, so we stopped. And he turned to me and he said, "You never know how you're going to be when you die. For this reason, you must really practice to the last moment of your life." And he said, I don't know how am I going to be. So I have to practice. And to me, this was so humbling, because often we have the idea, we do meditation and we get an amazing experience and then this is it. We can put our feet up and do something else. But he was saying, really, the practice is continuous. It's sudden, we see something suddenly, and then gradually we have to really make it more organic than again. So in a way, we're always learning, we're always practicing. Because, for example, if I look at myself, not that I have, you know, any great awakening or anything like this, but what I noticed with insight, for example, is that sometimes in meditation we can have some insight. Because what are insight? Often people, especially in the Vipassana circle, they talk about insight. Have you had an insight? You know, if you go on a 3-month retreat, you must at least have a few of them. You know, if you have none, you think, ooh, you know, it was not a good retreat. I did not have any insight. But what is an insight? Basically, an insight is when you see something you've never seen before. I think it's very important to see that. It's not some kind of flashbang, kind of, you know, wow. You know, you actually see something which was there in front of your nose, but you've never seen before. And you see it so clearly that in a way, it can change your life because it changes the way you look at yourself and you look at others. And I know when I was early in my time in Korea, that was my experience. You know, I was sitting this kind of 3 months at a time, 10 hours a day, and I was sitting with a group of 4 other ladies in one room, and so we're sitting, I were there. And after a month of sitting, asking, "What is this?" Suddenly, I saw something I have never thought before, never seen before. And what I saw was that I was totally self-centered. So you see, insight doesn't necessarily mean, you know, whoo. Actually, I saw so clearly. Because until that moment, because from an early age, I wanted to save the world. So I thought I was very compassionate. I always thought I was incredibly compassionate, always thinking of others first. But in that moment of insight, I saw I was totally self-centered. Everything I did, everything I thought, everything I felt was because of me. And I would say at that moment it was 98%, maybe 2% others. And so in a way that's the insight, that's what you see that I did not see before. And then from that, then all my life, then I practice gradually to incorporate that. So I diminish the percentage. My aim is toward 50%. Because I don't think we go further down, because we have the biological survival mechanism. So I think we have to see that we have insight, we see things, but then we have to incorporate them in our life. What does it mean to live in a non-self-centered way? What does it mean to live and being other-centered? And I think this is something we can look in so many different ways in our life. So now what I like to look in terms of what the context of the practice is, of the questioning, is the symbols of awakening. When we sit in meditation, I have the feeling, whatever we do, let it be the questioning, the awareness, whatever we do when we see it, often I have the feeling we see it and we wait for something special to happen. Don't you do that? Ooh, ooh, I feel different. Ooh, something is going to happen. Aren't we like this, waiting for something to happen? And I think often we have this idea that as we sit in meditation, we're going to get something. Something suddenly, boom, we're kind of going to get something. When actually, if we look, for example, in Korean Buddhism as the symbols of awakening, actually they're about losing, they're not about getting. And for example, in Korea, when you have an altar, you offer candle, incense, and water. And why you offer these things, about each of them is a symbol of awakening. And so the candle, actually, you light it, and as it gives light, it diminishes, it dissipates. So there is very much this symbol of selflessness. And to me also the candle, it is illuminated. So yourself, you are illuminated, but also it is illuminating. It gives light to others. And I think this is very much what awakening is about, that we become more selfless, but also we illuminate ourselves within, but also we illuminate others. We give light to others. The incense, again, there is this idea that the incense gives the fragrance as it disappears. As it consumes itself, it's spreading the fragrance. So again, this idea of selflessness, but with the incense also the idea of it's pervasive. The fact that the incense, the fragrance, does not go this way and say, ooh, I prefer them that way. And this one, ooh, I don't like them. I'm not going to go there. The fragrance of the incense goes everywhere. It reaches out to everybody without discrimination. So again, that symbol of awakening, that when we awaken, there is this compassion for everybody without any discrimination. And the water, it's symbol in two ways. First, that it is reflective, but when the water reflects everything just as it is, again, it doesn't discriminate. Oh, I don't want to reflect that. Oh, I want to reflect that more. It just reflects things just as they are. And when the things are gone, it's gone. No traces are left. And also because it's fluid. The idea that the water is fluid and adapt to everything. It doesn't kind of stay in the high place but go to the low place and adapt. So very much this idea of flexibility, adaptability in awakening. And also I think what is interesting in terms of the context of the question is the environment in terms of the idea of Buddhahood. Because this question is within the Zen idea of Buddhahood. Because if we look at the idea of Buddhahood, is that over time, it has changed. At the time of the Buddha, there was very much the idea that Buddhahood, there was just one Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, who attained it over many, 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 many lifetimes. He had to practice many, many lifetimes in order to be reborn as a Buddha. But my problem with that concept is that in his last lifetime, in order to become a Buddha, he had to be reborn as a man. So lady, this lifetime, forget it, you know. Which personally I think it's a bit weird, an awakening which is gendered. So anyway, this is traditional view. Then they started to have a development when they thought that actually awakening, one could become a Buddha in one lifetime. That it was like a seed that would grow, and you just had to water it, and then it would grow over one lifetime. And then there was the third development. And the third development was that actually you were awakened already. That actually we are, each of us has the Buddha nature, and each of us is awakened, but actually we don't see it. We don't know it. And this question is very much within that context of awakening being immanent. That in a way, at any moment, we can reach that dimension of awakening. But also at any moment it can be veiled, it cannot be kind of reached, it cannot be expressed. And when I was doing some research with the nun in Korea many years ago, I met this nun and I went to see many nuns and I was asking them, what is your practice? And this one, she was a teacher in a university teaching a Mahayana text, the Avatamsaka Sutra. And I said, what do you do this? She said, well, I became a nun and I was going to practice very hard, go to a hermitage and awaken for the sake of all. And then I read the Avatamsaka Sutta in my study. And in it, it said, all sentient beings are Buddhas, all Buddhas are sentient beings. Then I thought, ah, I am a Buddha. Okay, I don't have to go to the mountain. So she continued to study the Avatamsaka and that's what she teaches. And so I asked her, but what is your practice? She said, in the morning, I get up, I do a little my chanting, a little meditation, and then I go out of the nunnery and my practice is to be a Buddha. That today I am going to have the compassion and the wisdom of the Buddha. And that's what I plan to manifest. So that's her practice, to be a Buddha. And then at the end of the day, she reviews it. And she looks, how Buddha-like was I? How sentient being-like was that? Because also the Buddhas are sentient beings. And so that's what she does. That's what is her practice. So I think I will stop now for the talk. So now that you have done a little the question and seen a bit the context, are there any question or how did you find the questioning? How was it for you? Yes.
These are actually two questions that I had before your talk when we started doing the sitting and the walking exercises. Two questions. One was, while asking the question, what is it? Where is my attention supposed to be, like whether it is sitting or walking? That was one question. And the other question was, when I was asking myself, what is it? It was immediately being followed by the question, what is what? Like, I was confused, like, what's what? So, thank you.
So the first thing, the tension, actually, you're not actually told, I mean, traditionally, you're not actually told what to do with the question. I mean, generally what is suggested is that you ask the question with the belly. You try to bring the question to the belly, which seems a bit strange, I know. But it kind of works to kind of you try to bring the question to the belly, to ask it from the belly when you walk, when you sit, to kind of that's where you try to kind of put it, kind of bring it there.
It's the attention on the belly then, rather than, for example, when I'm meditating or when I'm walking, right, the attention is supposed to be on my breath, unless, well, in Zen meditation, the attention is on breath. In Vipassana or insight, it's on whatever that comes up for you, correct? So is that what I do while I'm asking what is it? Like I am paying attention to my breathing or to whatever sensations, and in parallel I ask what is it?
No, if you do it traditionally, you would not worry about the breath, about anything else. You would just ask the question. But if you wanted to anchor it so it would not be in the head, you would try to ask from the belly. You kind of try to kind of bring the energy down and ask it from the belly and forget about the breath or anything else. One teacher I knew, the way he did it was that you would watch the breath and then as you breathed out, you would ask a question. What is this? In order to help you to concentrate better that way. That's one technique. My teacher, he just used to say, and my teacher was very bare, he did not give you much explanation. Generally he said, you ask the question and you kind of make a circle with it. What is this? And before the circle kind of dissipates, you ask it again. What is this? So it kind of in a way like a circle, but not overly fastly repeating, but kind of trying to make this a circle of inquiry, of sensation, of questioning. Okay, that's for where you put it. Because once somebody asked Master Kuzan, Should I put the question in the special place in the forehead? And Master Kuzan said, if you want to put the question anywhere, put it in your toe. So, to kind of really bring it down, not to put it in the head.
And then what to do with the what is what?
It's coming. What is what? So, in terms of the what is this, generally the idea is to very much have it open-ended. But within the traditional way, it would be very much seen as asking, what is the mind? So in a way, turning, but not the mind, the brain, but what is the enlightened mind, in a way. So in a way, generally, the idea is that you turn back the light onto yourself. But personally, and so sometimes what they told you to do was, what is it that is walking? What is it that is hearing? What is it that is breathing? What is it that is tasting? So sometimes that's the way you told to ask the question. Personally, I just kind of would kind of just ask kind of very open-ended, no frame of reference, which is a little difficult to do. And sometimes people who have done awareness practice, what they find useful is to just be aware of the breath, be aware of the thought, for example, and then to say, what is this? And then generally the thought is experienced quite differently. So that's kind of a different take on it. Any other comments or yes?
So when I asked what is it, what is this, it seemed like, you know, I have a lot of thoughts, so they did seem to go away. And then with the body, you know, just like sort of what is this walking, I just noticed that I was walking, I think, that's all.
Yeah. Generally, it does this effect of making you more aware. If you do it, it generally brings you back to awareness, I would say, yeah.
And one other, what you just said about forgiveness, I think that was really interesting how we don't forget about things. However, it's very rare in our society that anyone asks for our forgiveness. And I guess I was just sort of thinking, I guess I could ask other people for their forgiveness, I mean, as a way to get the ball rolling or whatever, and also as a truth of, you know, acknowledging those things. But that was just something that struck me, that so it's hard to forget if somebody doesn't acknowledge, perhaps, and perhaps you just weren't aware of, you know, that they hurt your feelings or whatever.
Yeah, I would say it's true. That I feel there is this weird things with forgiveness in our society. It is true that we generally don't ask for forgiveness because we generally don't want to be at fault. Because we have the idea that if we are at fault and we acknowledge we are at fault, then they're going to get us. You know, there is a strange, kind of very utilitarian way of looking at that. For myself, I found that what I do a lot is to say, I'm sorry. If anybody say, I made a mistake, unless I'm really in an irritable mood, generally I will just say, oh, I'm sorry. And what I found is that as soon as I say I'm sorry, it deflates everything. Because you see, if somebody said, you know, you made a mistake, and generally you say, no, I did not, and you kind of all puffed up, and they puff up, it's kind of, you have two kind of chicken, kind of, you know, puffing and saying, ready for battle. But I found that, you know, if somebody said, oh, you did this, you know, you said that, you should not have said, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, very much, I think. And I personally find, you know, I'm generally very happy to say I'm sorry, and then from that place we can look at what happened, you know, and what I said, and how I did, and how the person perceived it, and how the person felt it, and then you can have some openness, and then some kind of dialogue, instead of kind of straight away being very fearful and kind of...
I was also interested in when you said it was like 50-50. I mean, I know I also feel, you know, the total self-centered. Actually, a friend of mine just died, and one of the things that struck me when I heard about it was that, well, what am I going to do without him? Or, you know, and I thought, oh, how self-centered. Here is this person, you know, and it was just like, boom, you know, like right there. But I was interested in the 50-50 because... The other thing I notice is that I get so consumed with what other people think and feel that we've all sometimes here we've talked about what's the right percentages, you know, how much can I stay here in my body with my own feelings and my own reactive mind and patterns, and then and that other tendency to just go out and not really being aware of anything here, you know, and so like I think I'm not being self-centered because I'm totally consumed by another person or what they want or whatever. So I don't know if you have any.
No, I think this is actually one good point. And with that, I have also another point, is that why I mentioned the 50-50 is because I think there is this idea in the spiritual life that what we're aiming is for the 0%. And personally, I don't think that we're aiming for 0% selflessness. I don't think this is a good idea. I think there is the imperative of the biological survival of this organism. If I don't take care of this organism, nobody else is going to take care of it. And so in a way, there is this 50% of I have to take care of this organism. And so I can be other-centered. To me, that's why I think of this organism, then I think of other organisms, other people, as much as myself. And of course, I think there is a kind of like a spectrum. But sometimes we just have to think of ourselves. If we are very ill, I know for myself, for a few years I was quite ill, and I had this very painful bout of pain. And then I would be in pain, and then all my friends would want to be compassionate to me and come and keep me company and think. And I just wanted to be alone with the pain because it was just so unbearable. And so kind of I would kind of be with them for about 5 minutes and then gently would say, you know, I would prefer to be alone. And I could see that was not very compassionate. You know, not to be there for their compassion. But I could see that at that moment I had to be more taking care of myself because that's what was happening. And then at other times you have what I would call the heroic impulse. You can really be totally there for the other person and really not think about yourself because at that moment that is required. And I have experienced that once when a friend phoned me, and just in her voice, I felt this. She was in a very dangerous state, and you know, ready to kill herself or something. So I went to see her. I mean, I had lots of plans for the day, but I went to see her, and I said, and I stayed all day with her, because time to time I would monitor myself. No, she's not stable yet. And I waited till about 5 o'clock, and then finally at 5 o'clock she was. I felt we passed the difficult moment and she was stable again. And then I could leave her. And that was when I did not think of myself whatsoever. And I think sometimes we respond to the situation in that way. But I think we cannot sustain that. We cannot sustain it. And so I think generally we go up and down. And then I would say, you know, again, the middle way, being in the medium of this kind of 50-50, I would say. Yes.
Thank you for telling the story of the person who goes out of the nunnery and comes back and evaluates what she did. And also for, I recently heard a tape of Stephen Batchelor in which he dared to say he didn't believe in reincarnation. It was very liberating for me because I haven't seen any evidence of it, and so it was very helpful for me. And in any case, the danger of coming back and evaluating the day for some of us is that we're going to come down on ourselves with so much judgment, and we're going to create such havoc. Do you have any suggestions on that score?
Yeah, what I would say that in a way this was our practice. In a way, our practice was not to watch the breath. Our practice was to be a Buddha. So I think within that context, there was a certain lightness that she would not beat herself up because she was not so Buddha-like. She would just say, I did this today. Not very Buddha-like. And would be light about it. Because she could see that actually, I think a practice was actually more to see that you move in and out. That being a Buddha is not fixed and being a sentient being is not fixed. So So I think within that, I think she did not have that type of judging, kind of, haha, how was I today? You know, ooh, five, not very good. You know, I think this is what I think you are talking about. And to me, this is why awareness practice, we have to be very careful. It doesn't come on top of judgment. It is not a judging practice. But I would say awareness practice is like what I was trying to do this morning in the guided meditation, was to see it is about acceptance. That when we really see, like when I talk about the self-centeredness, when I had that insight, I saw, wow, I am so self-centered. Actually, I did not feel bad at all. I just thought it was funny. I thought, well, look at me, running around, kind of just thinking of myself. And then I looked at everybody else in the room, we have four other people, and I saw they were doing exactly the same. And I thought, isn't it weird? We all self-centered. You know, I mean, for me it was very funny. It was very light. So I think you have a point here, which is very important, that the practice is not used to beat ourselves up, but more to see, why did I do this? What was behind it? To become interested, a bit like, you know, like a detective story. You know, you don't feel bad about the guy, you kind of think, you know, what happened? What are the conditions? You know, it's a bit the same. You know, you kind of, if you are in a bad mood, see that you are in a bad mood. Why is it you are in a bad mood? What happened? Is it just that you have this funny, weird feeling? Is it that you have this story in the mind that everybody is against you and nobody loves you? What is it? What is going on? Or is it that you are plain tired? You are exhausted, and whenever you are exhausted, you kind of think in that way. So, in a way, to kind of go into the condition in the moment, to me, this is a key. That's why I would not do what she did. You know, I would not look at the end of the day, how was it? I mean, for me, this is a bit, for myself, a waste of time in terms that I prefer to be in the moment. What is happening in the moment, not, you know, how has been the day? I think for her, it was part of that Buddha practice. But personally, I would not do this because I would not see the point, because it was a bit late in the day to look at it. I personally prefer to look at it in the moment. You know, what's happening with the feeling tone? What's happening with the mind? What's happening with the body? So in a way, to use awareness practice in that way, to kind of like to see yourself as a discoverer, you know, an adventurer, you know, somebody who's kind of open, okay, what am I going to see in this moment? So you don't judge it, but you accept it, and then you see, how can I creatively engage with this? Sometimes we just have to accept it. This is the way I feel. I mean, when I used to live in community for 6 years in England, and that's really generally, living in community really brings your negativity up. And I have a tendency to be relatively easily fiery and irritable. So sometimes I would wake up, and I would say to Stephen, I am angry. I felt this kind of, you know, seizing kind of in the body. And he said, but what about? And I said, I don't know. You know, and so in a way, over time, that was very good, living in community, because I could really see that actually there was this pattern, this tendency, but I did not have to act on it. But it was more a kind of a travel of discovery, to see how does this happen, what are the conditions, how does it manifest, how can I look at it, how can I work with it. So that's why I would recommend not to judge, because that doesn't help. And then you judge the judging of the judging of the judging, so it's kind of a little kind of like a loop. But to kind of be interested in what happened. That, you know, a meditator, a Buddhist, is not just kind of like a kind of a carbon copy of this or that. But it's kind of whatever is happening in your moment, which is different from somebody else's moment. Yes?
As I sat with the question, what is this? I knew I wasn't supposed to be looking for an answer. But repeatedly, a sense of fear would lodge itself that I became strongly aware of at the end of asking the question. And it was unsettling. And then I remembered your articulation of the three kinds of people. And am I correct in remembering that this is the third version and the direction would be to move away from the question for a moment and onto the breath to sort of catch my breath and then return to the question?
Yes, yes, yes. I would say to kind of be very gentle in the way you use the question if that's what happened. Because it's kind of, it is unsettling. There is no doubt, because generally sometimes we like things to be known. We like to know what's what. We like to be certain. We like to be, you know, to know what goes going on. And then to ask this question is kind of awakening us a little to the unknowing, to the fact that of course we know certain things, but also there is a lot of things we don't know. That actually in this moment life is a mystery. And that can be a little unsettling, you know, to kind of, you know, with that moment of life, which is precious, which is uncertain. So then I would say, yes, come back to the breath, and then maybe later on, again, one time, the question. So you can just create a little feeling tone, not kind of such a pounding. You don't want to pound yourself with it. But just kind of gently, you know, have this kind of, you know, on the sea sometimes you have these little waves, and the wave lasts a long time. It's a bit the same. In this way, you don't want to kind of be the surf pounding.
Thank you.
What I observed was that the thoughts I had seemed to just stop, and then I started looking around. I could see the orchid, I could see the various statues, and just things around. So it was very pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And not necessarily just focusing on something esoteric, but rather what is around.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, so it has that very immediate kind of effect.
It's really very pleasing. Mm-hmm. It just stops and starts fresh.
Yeah.
And then you're just there. Nothing is happening really, but you're just walking.
Yeah, very much so.
You said something that you have to be, they say you have to be a man to be a Buddha. Is that, who say that and why do they say that? Or?
Yeah, well, it's in the suttas. is it in the suttas themselves? I would have to ask my husband. He's kind of, Stephen is the specialist of the sutta. You know them inside out. As far as I know, it's in the text somewhere that actually to become the kind of the Buddha like Siddhartha, the kind of the one all accomplished Buddha, you have to be reborn as a man, because this is one of the mark, I think it's a 52 mark of the great being.
To be a man?
No. To be the Buddha. To be the ultimate Buddha, this is kind of Indian mythology. I don't think this is Buddhism per se. It was a context in which the Buddha found himself. So the Buddha is in the Indian mythology, and the Indian mythology has it that a great awakened person has 52 or 51 marks of being, which is really weird, in his body. And one of the marks is that it's a male body. And then, you know, he is supposed to have this huge tongue and this huge ear. I mean, if you really represent the 52 mark, this is not a human being. You have a monster. But that's another story. That's another story. So, no, it is in the text somewhere, but in reference with the 52 marks, which are, I think, kind of part of the mythology of India. I mean, it is there. I cannot say it is not there if it is there. But is it in the Pali canon itself? I don't know. That next time Tani Saro Bhikkhu comes, you can ask him where it is. If it's in the commentary or if it's in the Pali canon. or maybe guilt can find the source of where that is, but it is there somewhere, that's for sure.
Yeah, and also about the question, what is this? It almost to me is like a childlike awareness, where you're not really, you know, thinking, putting ideas, putting opinions, and it kind of breaks that storyline. It kind of, and I'm sure it could bring different feelings at different moments, depending, I guess, on mm-hmm. what kind of a mood we are in, or whatever.
Yeah, I think it can be used in different ways. I think sometimes, you know, as you practice with the question, sometimes the words of the question are very present. And sometimes the words of the question are not there. And it's just a feeling of awareness, of what I would call a potent awareness, of a very alive awareness. And within that alive awareness, then you generally don't have that much thoughts. Or you're not caught by the thought or the feelings or the sensations.
So just one, I'm sorry, please, one last question. What in Buddhist tradition, as far as, you know, you can look at it like yourself, why did I say this life should come about, I mean, with all of this meditation or not, or the purpose of our just being, you know?
Oh, the purpose of us being here.
And, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, how do they explain it? Do they have any certain explanation? Or?
Oh, of course. There is lots of. I mean, you see, the Buddha. Again, I've not such a good memory as my husband, and I don't read as much. But as far as I know, there is 10 questions that the Buddha would not answer because he did not feel it would help with the practice itself of awareness, and one of them was what. In a way, what is the origin of the universe and why the universe origin and what, you know, all these kind of metaphysical questions. Generally, he tried not to answer those. But in terms of the tradition, of course, after his death, there was lots of explanation, you know, of the origin of the universe and why we're here. And so in the traditional Buddhism, there is very much this idea of samsara, the fact that there is all this round of rebirth and that there is suffering and that the idea is to kind of awaken, to kind of, in a way, get out of the cycle of rebirth. So, in a way, to be liberated. That's a traditional way of looking at it. Personally, I, like Stephen, I must say, I am not that keen on reincarnation. I mean, I don't mind one way or another, but it doesn't make a difference to me. I don't think about it. And to me, what is important is what we do in this life. And personally, the meaning of my life would be the fact that for whatever reason, I am alive and I breathe. Like other people, I have the breath, I breathe. And from breathing, being able to breathe, being able to be a conscious human being, I have a potential. I have a potential for wisdom and compassion. And for me, the practice is actually to be able for me to discover, to uncover, and to manifest that wisdom for compassion, that potential for wisdom and compassion. That's the way I would look at it myself. But different traditions have different ideas about all these things and different kind of philosophical ideas. But I would say in general, it boils down to using your potential to the fullest and to express it in wisdom and compassion.
Thinking about the question, at first I found that it brought up the response in me of noting, you know, which is something that we often do in the Vipassana meditation. And so I guess that's the question that I'm asking. What is this? Oh, it's a thought. Oh, it's, you know, walking or my foot being placed or whatever. And so I had somewhat similar trains of thought or trains of not thought, whatever you call them. And at first I was disappointed because I thought, oh no, this is the same thing. And I found that noting is sometimes useful for me, particularly if I'm really stuck on something or agitated or something. But there's a lot of times when noting isn't that useful for me. And so then as I stayed with the question of what is this, I actually found that it hastened the time when I got past needing the noting. So that was interesting. I know my meditation is getting deeper when I get to the point when I stop noting and I don't have to do that anymore, and then it's a lot more open. And this, I think, got me there faster, or seemed to point in that direction. So that was interesting, and I think worth exploring. Thank you.
Yeah, because I think this would be, I think, again, noting can be very useful, but I don't think it is useful for everybody, especially if you have a tight, if one feels a little tight, I would say don't do noting, because noting kind of, you know, focus you, but kind of, I think, can tighten you a little. And it is true that, of course, when we meditate, I think it's very important to see that we have a ground of meditation. We might just watch the breath, we might not. I personally question. That's what I come back to. And so, in a way, we generally will come back to what is familiar. But then, as we practice, for example, with this question, then, in a way, it will go past what we do familiarly. And then it can open up in this more open space. I see the practice of the questioning a little akin to the practice of listening, that of helping us to open to the moment, to open the awareness.